Hello and welcome to this week's Peaky Pie. And you know what? I've decided I'm going to have an official, I don't know if I want to say segment or it will be, you know, an occasional feature because I'm still going to do other stuff, but of Google Roulette. Now, if you've been listening to me for a while, you know that I sometimes do that partway through an episode, and occasionally it's quite a lot of fun, the crazy shit that comes up. Or the things that we actually learn that it's like, oh my God, that's the missing piece. Well, I decided I'm just going to make a whole episode. And in fact, I'm going to invite you, before I get into this, to email me like sroit, S-R-O-I-T, at pinkyswearpress.com if you have ideas for things I should Google. Or right now, for some reason, I guess my Windows, whatever, it's Bing. Yeah, my laptop, it's Bing. So Bing Roulette, but Google Roulette sounds better, right? Same difference. Sort of. I don't know. I have found that there are differences between the search engines. You can also find me on Twitter at PodPinky. And of course, I have Instagram, Pinky_podcast. And I'm on the TikToks, S_Roit. So I was going to do News of the Weird. And I admit, I started to Google it, and it wasn't the sort of thing I thought was going to pop up, and it was actually kind of depressing. Not depressing, but more like, bleh, that's no fun. So I'm going to, and these things that I find are nothing that I have read ahead of time, so this could either go really well or be a complete train wreck, but that's the whole point. That's part of the fun. So how about I Bing spooky, weird tales. Okay, so then it pops up actual comic book covers. Oh, I like it. The very first one is top 10 spooky tales based on weirder true stories. Lists are always fun, right? We like lists. So, this one is from October 29, 2020 by Nate Youngman. And I love that it even says it's fact-checked by Jamie Frater. So it's been fact-checked. Unfortunately, this looks like one of those click to continue things, damn it, but we'll see what happens. Frightful stories of cryptids, aliens, and urban legends get retold every Halloween. Campfire versions embellish the truth for cheap scares. The following origins of 10 popular tropes prove that sometimes real life is even more bizarre. Neighbors poison Halloween candy at number 10. Ronald O'Brien ruined everyone's fun. Cautious parents inspect their children's Halloween haul to make sure no nefarious prankster tainted it. They usually test this by courageously eating some portion of the candy themselves. Only one recorded child has died from poisoned Halloween candy. It was not done by a demented boogeyman, but the child's own father. In 1974, 8-year-old Timothy O'Brien went trick-or-treating. Timothy and his 5 friends approached an ominous house with its lights off. No one answered when they rang the doorbell. Instead, Ronald O'Brien walked out of the shadows. He handed each kid a restapled 21-inch pixie stick coated in cyanide. Damn it! I loved pixie sticks! Floundering in debt, Ronald killed his son to cash in on the life insurance policy. On June 3rd, 1975, a jury convicted Ronald of 1 charge of capital murder and 4 counts of attempted murder. Following the unsolved Chicago Tylenol poisoning, the very real threat of a child dying no longer seemed like some quirky holiday superstition. Retellings turned the myth of deadly candy into the far more innocuous problem of needles in the chocolate. It only made sense that the type of sadistic monster willing to feed trick-or-treaters razor blades would be the same kind of person who hands out apples. Number 9. Piranhas are flesh-eating monsters. Are you going to tell me they're not? Oh my God. Okay. Nature-loving Teddy Roosevelt unknowingly spread one of its most groundless myths. Piranhas' reputation as pocket-sized demons that devour meat in seconds is unjustified. The fish are omnivorous. Some species are strictly herbivores. They only eat animals bigger than insects or other fish when they are starved, such as when President Roosevelt first saw them. In 1913, Brazilian dignitaries were eager to impress the former president. Desperate to make an impressive spectacle, they closed off a section of the Amazon River. For days, the isolated Paranas were denied food. In honor of Roosevelt's arrival, the locals dropped a live cow into the swarm. Like the Velociraptor frenzy in Jurassic Park, the school stripped apart the bovine. Chunks of barren bone were all that was left to float to the top. Recalling the event in his travelogue, Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Roosevelt described the fish as the embodiment of evil ferocity. Schlocky B-grade movies like James Cameron's Piranha 2, The Spawning, ingrained the misconception in popular culture. Wow, that's one I didn't know. Excuse me, got my Guinness here. Need a sip? I should say ahead of this podcast, you know, you can always welcome, just drink right along, my lovelies, drink right along. Number 8. And they have a picture of Marilyn Manson or Brian Warner. Celebrities get their ribs removed. Onstage antics are meant to be for shock. Theatric rocker Marilyn Manson's legacy has been eclipsed by the rumor that he removed his ribs to suck his penis. I saw that, you know, when you're reading, you see ahead a little bit. And I promise you, like I said, I have not vetted these stories. We're learning this together. I put in the search words and clicked on it and have never seen these before. So I was like, is that what I'm about to read? Okay. Let me say that again. The rumor is that he removed his ribs so that he could suck his own peen. The oft-trot-out line has no validity. I'm almost disappointed. This allegation was as false for the first person to have applied to them. You know, the grammar here is not my fault. He unleashed horrors far more appalling than the beautiful people. Hey, that song's actually kind of good, dude, but whatever. Rumors around celebrities removing their ribs is frequently targeted against women looking for unorthodox weight loss. That strain of story still gets retold with various stars like Cher, Elizabeth Taylor, Jane Fonda, Raquel Welch, or Britney Spears. The salacious wrinkle that someone would opt for the surgery for self-fellatio is attributed to Gabrielle D'Annunzio. D'Annunzio trafficked in gossip. To bolster his fame, D'Annunzio spread scandalous tales that he cooked baby flesh, stitched a robe to exposed his penis, and stole the Mona Lisa. Aim high, dude, aim high. We always say, shoot for the stars. Despite his controversial history, Italy still heralds D'Annunzio as one of their nation's great poets. I don't even know, what did he write about? Anyway, the world is more familiar with his other work, which is fascism. That's according to this. The first modern fascist state was the city of Fiume. I don't know if I'm saying that right. The enclave was seized by D'Annunzio's 2,000-strong militia. Italian forces tried to claim the small town for 15 months. Eventually, the navy compelled surrender. Benito Mussolini admired D'Annunzio's resolve. After his rise to power, Mussolini modeled himself after D'Annunzio, and D'Annunzio was wary of Il Duce, is that right? Deuce? Legitimacy, but he did suggest an easy symbol to identify followers of the cause. Initially known as the Roman salute, the Nazis adopted the hand gesture as Sieg Heil. Wait, are you as confused as I am right now? This guy would have been way before Marilyn Manson's time. Oh, I guess what they were trying to say is that the reason that sort of rumor could run, or where it all began in the first place, would be with Gabriel D'Annunzio. Okay. Hey, guys, whoever wrote this, listverse.com, I know I read who wrote this at the top, but you could stand to be a little more clear in your listing. For a second, I was like, what? I thought this D'Annunzio was a modern person. I'm confused, but that is Google or Bing roulette for you. Oh, here's one we've all, well, a lot of us have probably heard of. Number 7, the Jersey Devil. Two people birthed the Jersey Devil. See, that's how it's written. Two people birthed the Jersey Devil. I mean, we all can tell you what that sounds like. That sounds like, well, I'll be damned. So it's real, and it was born as a baby to this couple. Where are these guys? Let's go interview them. Grammar is your friend, guys. I don't care if you're writing just a quickie clickbait thing for a list verse. You could try just a little harder. Yes, I'm looking at you, list verse. Who is this again? Elmon. Nate Youngman. Dude, you had a fact checker, but not an editor. What the? Okay. Let me scroll back down. I believe what they're actually trying to say is that there were two people responsible for this rumor. Okay, then. Tradition holds that Mother Leeds conceived her... Oh, no. My apologies. Tradition holds that Mother Leeds conceived her 13th child in pact with Satan. Two people birthed the Jersey... I don't know. It's still weird. The deformed offspring sprouted wings, hooves, and a tail. The second culprit is nearly as unbelievable, Benjamin Franklin. Two people birthed... I don't know, that's still a weird paragraph. I'll retract a little bit of what I said, but there have been other issues. The Leeds family lacked the same name recognition as their founding father rival. They still shaped history. Daniel Leeds' almanac was the earliest printing in the New Jersey colony. It's anti... Oh, and it's... I-T apostrophe S. I'm not going to retract anything. There should be no apostrophe. This is terrible. but they're cool stories, okay, man? But you need a proofreader and a copy editor. Okay. Its anti-Quaker stance is among the first political attacks in American history. Quakers retaliated by calling Daniel Leeds Satan's harbinger. For a second, I read it as hamburger, and that's so much funnier. Should we just go with that? Let's start our own urban legend. I want to start my own urban legend. It's Satan's hamburger. There you got a hamburger. I'm glad you pay you dues. I can't even speak anymore. Wait, I need some more Guinness. I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, but it needs to be Satan's helper. You know, like hamburger helper? Yeah. Anyway. Daniel passed almanac responsibilities to his son, Titan. Cool name, bro. Under his pseudonym, Poor Richard, Benjamin Franklin joked in his competing almanac that astrological calculations prophesized Titan's imminent death. Well, that's not very nice, dude. As the prediction passed in 1733, the very much not dead Leeds called Franklin a liar. Franklin retorted that he was still right. Titan was just a ghost. By the time of Titan's real death in 1738, anti-British sentiment turned the Leeds family into a symbol of ridicule. Their family crest was mocked as the Leeds Devil. I've heard of that. A 20th century huckster trying to stir up business towards his store, revitalize... There's no commas here. I'm trying to put them in myself. A 20th century huckster trying to stir up business towards his store, revitalize and embellish horror stories from the Leeds Devil into the name of the cryptozoological chimera that terrorizes the Garden State's forest and occasionally the National Hockey League. That's how it reads if you don't put in your own punctuation. Hey, do you think maybe I could be auditioning here for a job as a proofreader for listverse.com? There's a lot of websites out there like that. You know, throw me a few bucks, I'll fix it for you. Whew! Where are we? Number six. Nazis, UFOs. Let us find out if it's actually meant to be possessive, because it does say UFO apostrophe S. UFOs what, man? UFOs what? Like any good melodrama, Baron Edward Bulwer Lytton's life starts with "It was a dark and stormy night." The hackney cliche first appeared in Bulwer Lytton's 1830 novel, Paul Clifford. There's no commas. Yes, I'm bitching about it. You need to appreciate that this is difficult to read to you, sight unseen, when it's written this way. Because I'm, you know, either have to think on my feet or just run with it. Or think on my ass because I'm sitting. But back to this. Other common phrases like the almighty dollar or the pen is mightier than the sword were coined within the pages of Bulwer Lytton's works. Hey, cool. I didn't know that. I like finding that out. His life was as florid as his writing. In retribution for locking her in an insane asylum under false pretenses, his wife, Rosina Doyle Wheeler, sabotaged Bulwer Lytton's parliamentary campaign. You go, Rosina! Yeah, bad bitch! She leaked misinformation that he was having an illicit affair with future Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli. Oh, I love it! She even went for the male-male romance. We stan you, Rosina. I stan you. No story better encapsulates his insane life than the far-reaching consequences of his 1871 pot boiler called The Coming Race. Okay, wait, I need some more Guinness. The pulp novel was among the first science fiction texts to use the plot device of a traveler unearthing a mythical land. Don't make fun of me. It's really difficult to say texts properly. Texts. Otherwise, you just say texts. Text messaging. And if you've been listening to me for a while, you know that I've had a speech problem since I was a child. And if you haven't been listening to me, I have a speech problem at times. So don't hate. Okay. The main character of this novel discovered a secret underground commune inhabited by a race of angels called Vrilya, powered by the fluid Vril. A fan of the occult, Bulwer Lytton's fictional realm referenced common pseudoscientific ideas of the day. In 1947, researcher William Lay inspired real-life quests to tap into Vril's power. One such organization, the Vril Society, which was allegedly founded when psychic Maria Orsic used her... I know. Just a minute. Because you can't see this. Used her telepathic hair to communicate with aliens. Intergalactic beings equipped the Third Reich with superior technology in the waning days of the war. So how come they lost, man? Shockingly, historians are not convinced the society existed. The absurd idea of aliens working with the Nazi high command permeated pop culture. Tongue-in-cheek video games like Iron Sky, Invasion, the Wolfenstein franchise. I definitely have heard of that one. I haven't played it, but it's actually available on my PlayStation Network. Or the zombie levels of Call of Duty. Now, I know a bunch of you out there have played that, are actually based on this conspiracy theory. Along with all of their other wrong-headed views, some neo-Nazi sects, that's another one that's hard to say, S-E-C-T-S, instead of sounding like you're saying sex, they still maintain that Vril is out there. And I am suddenly, hold on while I write this down, because I feel a wacky podcast episode coming up. This is another reason I like to do this. Is sometimes it gives you an idea of, hey, what's a wild podcast episode I could do? And I think I'm going to look up this Maria Orsic and the Vril Society. That's hilarious. Okay, number 5. Oh, God, there might be another one I can look up here. This word alone, I need to write it down. Hey, you know, this is what you get when you get a Google roulette. Okay. Chemirocha. Chemirocha. Jimmy Rogers was a legend in life. Death made him a deity. As the father of country music, generations of composers were inspired by Rogers' pioneering yodel. A fraction of the artists shaped by Rogers' catalog included Bob Dylan, Louis Armstrong, Hank Williams, Muddy Waters, and Howlin' Wolf. His influence stretched far beyond the American South, including, curiously, Kenya's Great Rift Valley. British missionaries brought the word of God and the yelps of Rogers. To further spread their message, evangelists played gramophone copies of country records. The Kipsigis tribe were particularly fond of Jimmy Rogers. Through bungled translation, the formative country singer's name became Chemirocha, and Kimaroka entered the lexicon for anything new or interesting. In the 1950s, ethnomusicologist Hugh Tracy returned to the Kipsigis village to field record local songs. The phrase Kimaroka morphed into lore. Because of his unnaturally high-pitched voice, Kimaroka was described as a half-man and half-antelope fawn. Either in myth or his music, Jimmy Rogers achieved immortality. Wow, I didn't know it was going to end up in some cryptozoology. That one was really cool. I don't know if you think so, but that was a cryptid I'd never heard of. And here we go. It's actually connected to a famous country singer. I think that's really fascinating because here you have the origin of something that sounds, if you looked up the legend, I wonder, maybe we should look it up as part of the offshoot of the roulette here. I'll write it down to Kimaroka. I wonder what the attributes of this Kimaroka are, Chimirocha, I don't know how to say it, but to stumble across a cryptid I've never heard of, and then you actually have the origin of it that is so silly and innocuous. Now I want to know if it's like this scary, dangerous, crazy creature, or if the creature description is also funny. Don't worry, I'll do it, okay? I'll Google that after we get through this list, because now I'm really curious, do they describe it as ferocious and this and that? It's like, sadly, I've already given you the spoiler alert, but it would be funny if it's described as just really creepy, and it's from a country yodel. Oh my God. Okay, number 4, the Loch Ness Monster. Murmurs of some creature lurking within Scotland's Loch Ness were told for centuries. The modern notion of an aquatic reptile comes from a single 1934 photograph published in the Daily Mail. Oh, the Daily Mail. Mm-hmm. Dubbed the Surgeon's Photo, the grainy black and white visual of a long neck and a humped figure breaking through the water became the standard depiction of the beast. You've all seen it, and maybe you didn't know what it was, but you've seen it. I'll share it. Everyone knows this picture, or, you know, a lot of people do. Now, everyone involved in this, by the way, with this photo, has admitted that it was a hoax. In 1933, the Inverness Courier printed the first sighting of the legendary animal. The Daily Mail wanted to get in on this craze. They stationed Marmaduke Wetherall. I love this name! I only know the dog, Marmaduke Wetherall, to gather evidence. In December 1933, he discovered a set of footprints on the shoreline. Yeah, because there's never footprints on a shoreline, dude. Natural History Museum scientists, examining the plaster copies, determined they were made by a dried hippo's foot from an umbrella stand. Mocked for being so gullible, Wetherall concocted his revenge. Oh, I see. So Wetherall approached his stepson Christian Sperling to create a fake monster. Molding some clay on top of a toy submarine, Sperling photographed the replica as it drove around the lake. To lend some credibility, the duo employed noted surgeon Colonel Robert Wilson to hand the pictures to the Daily Mail. Marmaduke Wetherall embarrassed the British tabloid just as they embarrassed him. Oh, now I just heard a podcast that one of the things they covered was this. Or actually, I was looking something up. You know what? I think I was looking something up. Did I do that episode? Oh my God, so many episodes. Such a blur. Number 3, The Babysitter and the Man Upstairs. And maybe you've heard of the film, of course, When a Stranger Calls. 1979's When a Stranger Calls begins with the classic twist of a panicked babysitter realizing that the killer's call was coming from inside the house. I was alive then. I remember that. It was frickin' scary. The tragic crime that inspired it was even more of a macabre irony. The phone cord she thought could save her killed her. On March 18, 1950, 13-year-old Janet Christman babysat Ed and Ann Romack's 3-year-old son, Gregory. Worried about her safety, Ed lent Janet a shotgun if anyone suspicious stopped by. It was never used. Around 10:35 p.m., the local sheriff's department received a frantic phone call. In between just disjointed breaths, the dispatcher barely made out a plea for help. The phone was then cut dead. Within 3 hours, Christman was too. She had been bludgeoned, raped, and strangled with wires from an electric iron and the telephone. But thankfully, Gregory was unharmed. I actually feel like I looked this up or I was going to do an episode on it. Wow, freaky. Jurisdictional squabbles hampered the investigation. The Romacs lived 100 yards over the city limits. Competing agencies feuded over withheld evidence. This divide allowed the prime suspect, Robert Mueller, to evade justice. Mueller had a lecherous reputation in the community for young virgins. His occasional babysitter, Mueller, lusted after Janet in particular. She was an occasional babysitter for this person. The stationary shotgun suggests Christman knew the culprit. The night of the murder, Mueller excused himself for 2 hours to allegedly meet his doctor. Mueller's doctor says he never showed up. Most damning, Mueller phoned the Romex the morning after the murder. Obviously out of compassion, he asked if they needed any assistance cleaning blood. Yes, that's sarcasm. This call came before the press reported the murder. Taken to a barn outside the city limits, police interrogated Mueller. I definitely researched this. Denied a proper setting, the questions were inadmissible. And Mueller died in 2006, never having been charged with any crime. So officially, it's unsolved. Synchronicities are so interesting because I totally researched this. That's why it's so fresh in my head. Okay, and then we go from that horrific story to number two. Gray aliens probe butts. But I can't do Minions voices. I wish I could. But bottom. Okay, never mind. That's good stuff. Okay, there are two possibilities. Believers contend that on September 9th, 1961, husband and wife Barney and Betty Hill were abducted by a flying saucer somewhere along New Hampshire's White Mountains. Aliens shoved a needle through Betty's navel and a metallic capsule inside Barney's rectum. This is a very famous UFO case, by the way, and I have covered this in past episodes. Skeptics maintain that it was all made up. Neither view justifies why so many people have shared this delusion. Logic explains away most of the supposed details. Sleep-deprived, the Hills drove 5 hours nonstop in the middle of the night. In this foggy state, an observatory tower light weaving along the wooded road could be confused for a craft. The visual of gray-skinned aliens with an enlarged forehead closely resembled the costume design of a beast in an episode, The Outer Limits, aired 2 weeks before Barney shared his account. The intrusive surgery resembles accounts of accidental awareness Barney might have experienced if anesthesia wore off in a recent tonsillectomy. Physical evidence like Betty's ripped dress, Barney's scuffed shoes, or circular dents on the car are harder to rationalize unless this whole story was created by an unscrupulous doctor. Also remember something about they were hypnotized. And a lot of the details actually came out, and it was consistent. I feel like I remember that. The Hills were reluctant to publish their account. They only came forward at the recommendation of their psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon, in 1964. Yeah, here we go. Under hypnosis, the Hills were susceptible for the opportunistic doctor to plant false memories. See, this is clearly they've made their decision and decided that it's fake, that it was planted. You make your own, you know, you come to your own conclusion on that. I've done an episode on it and you can read about it. The couple did not initially seek out the counseling, though, in the first place, over concerns about a three-year-old hazy recollection. They faced tangible problems. Barney's doctor warned that he needed to treat stress-induced high blood pressure and ulcers. His first psychiatrist concluded that Barney's anxiety stemmed from being a black man married to a white woman. Active in the civil rights movement, the stigma of the interracial marriage caused the two mental unrest. Shortly before their sighting, the waitress at the diner they visited, was disgusted by the couple's race. Oh, what is this finishing sentence? I'm going to read it for you just so you know what he wrote. Black and white together make gray. Okay, yeah. Blech. I don't like that one. Number one, Elvis faked his death. Jimmy Ellis wanted to be a star. Every record with his name on it flopped. Critics always complained he sounded too much like Elvis Presley. Is that a bad thing? I guess it is if you're trying to have your own name. After 15 years of scrounging by, Ellis abandoned music. He settled on just being himself. Then Elvis died. Side note of my own here, I actually remember that. We were on one of our two-week vacations where my dad was driving the old Country Squire station wagon. We had the Coleman, it's a camper actually, that you pop up and pull the sides out. It's not just, it's sort of a tent slash camper, if you know, you know. And we were not far from around Kansas City, Missouri, you know, to go to Worlds of Fun and this and that, probably on our way back from some of our vacation. And because the whole night at the campsite, they were playing Elvis songs and was feeding Captain Crunch to the chipmunks. But what I remember most is when it came across the radio, my dad, we all felt the car just slow down because I think he just took his foot off the gas. He didn't necessarily hit the brakes, but you could feel it. Like, it shocked him. He was like, oh, you know, and they grew up with that. And I grew up with it. And it was very shocking and very, very sad. So there's a little bit of my recollection, you know. That was in August. Yeah, family vacation. All right, back to the article. Mercury Records Vice President Shelby Singleton is one of music's great con men. His first shameless scam was buying Sun Records' back catalog, the Memphis studio that launched the King of Rock and Roll's career. In 1972, Singleton released Ellis singing 1950 standards under the implication this was the lost first Elvis recordings. By the time of Elvis's death in 1977, Singleton hatched a more fantastical con. Loosely inspired by Elvis's biography, Gail Brewer Giorgio's unpublished novel, where is my speech going? Unpublished novel, Orion, the Living Superstar of Song, tells of a Southerner who lucked into becoming the world's most popular singer. After squandering his fame on drugs and vice, Orion faked his death to find peace. Dressed in bedazzled jumpsuits, jet black hair, and a rhinestone mask, Singleton marketed Ellis as Orion. Local publications, not too worried about their accuracy, ran that Orion was actually Elvis reincarnated. Singleton fostered such theories by coyly re-recording old Jerry Lee Lewis albums as duets with Orion. 11 Orion albums were released between 1978 and 1982, including 9 charting country singles. Despite his burgeoning success, Ellis hated this fabricated identity. He grew convinced that he was Vernon Presley's illegitimate child. Sharing the same biological father might explain Ellis's uncanny similarities. On New Year's Eve 1983, Ellis tore off the Orion mask. He renounced his alter ego to manage a pawn shop in Alabama. In 1998, he was killed. He was killed in a botched. That's it. That's what it says. He was killed in a botched. In a botched. Now we have to Google that now, don't we? In a botched what? Place your bets right now. Was it a botched robbery? Because it was a pawn shop. That's what I'm going with. A botched robbery. Was it a botched surgery to not look like Elvis anymore? Or was it a botched... I'm blanking. He was 53 years old, by the way. A botched duck hunt. Yeah, there we go. All right, let's go ahead and let's look this up. Shall we just try? All right, here he is, Jimmy Orion Ellis. You know, he does kind of look like him with that mask on. Here he is with the mask. He was born in, they don't even know where he was born. Either Pascagoula, Mississippi, Oroville, Alabama, or Washington, D.C., at least according to Wikipedia. La, la, la. Okay, how did he die? Oh, I win. December 12th, 1998, Ellis was murdered during a robbery in his store, Jimmy's Pawn Shop. Jeffrey Lee was convicted of the murder of Ellis and Ellis's ex-wife, Elaine Thompson, who was working as an employee at the store, and also the attempted murder of employee Helen King. Damn, dude. Jeffrey Lee, what an asshole. Lee was sentenced to death, and his appeal against the sentence was refused October 9, 2009. What a douche. I mean, the killer. All right, what else were we going to Google? Dun, 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 dun. I need some Google Roulette music theme song now, don't I? Kimmy. So I Googled Kimarocha, and I actually get a singer. I don't get to... Okay. And then we get to how an American country singer became that. I want to know... Okay, this is all about Jimmy Rogers, but I want to know what the actual creature is described as. It's not coming up. Let's try this. Creature. Okay. This might work. The incredible story of the fawn Chimarocha, or Chimarocha. I feel like it would be Chimarocha. This was actually written March 29, 2022 at blog.treedom.net. So they tell the story again of, the yodeling.
Thank you, folks. So chance of this must have everything, okay?
Good. Okay. That's really good. And there's a little. I want you to know that he was making that train sound himself. All right. So I'm still trying to, I'm skimming down here. Okay. One day during one of the many trips he took across Africa, Tracy arrived in a village in the Bomey district of Kenya. The date was 15 September 1950, and it was precisely that day that Tracy recorded 34 songs sung and played by the people from the Kipsigis tribe. I'm going to share the link to this page because there are examples of those recordings, which I bet are really fascinating. So among the recordings are three that Hugh Tracy filed under the names Chimarocha 1, 2, and 3. And versions 1 or 2 are sung by men, but the most famous is the third. It is sung, as Tracy notes, by Kemutwe Ketenya with Kipsigis Girls. And I know I'm not pronouncing that right. So from what apparently they hear here, it's a young girl with a group of her peers forming a chorus and is accompanied by the sound of a stringed instrument similar to a lyre called a kubanganet. The song lasts just over a minute and has a hypnotic and alienating charm. Alienating, yeah. Especially due to the repetition of the word Kimaroka or Chimarocha. And it's said here that that actually means Jimmy Rogers. Let me see if we can know. Hello, Jimmy Rogers. Okay, it is Chimarocha. My instinct was right on that. Cool. I still am not finding anything about this supposed creature with antlers and stuff, though. Okay, wait. The figure of Rogers Chimarocha thus assumed almost mythical traits of a mysterious and fascinating creature, some kind of African faun. And that's all it really says about it there, unless I were to try to go through. This is a very long article. I will share it. I will share it on the show notes. Wow, you know, sometimes you start out, you have no idea. That's why this is fun. You have no idea what you're going to come up with. And then it swerves into some very fascinating, even tragic, you know, as well as funny tales. And now I'm going to back up and listen to this, because last time I tried to play music for you all, even though I have the microphone right here and it's coming out of my laptop, it was like beep, just this whiny buzzy sound. So if you hear me talking about music and like, oh, doesn't that sound cool, but you hear no music, I'm going to link this page so you can go listen to it for yourself, because for some reason this has a problem. The mic, I don't know. Anyway, that was the first crazy-ass, completely unscripted, official Google roulette, or Bing roulette. Now that I'm done with that, send me in some ideas for what I should Google. Make sure you have a shot of something or a drink, you know, when you join me for it. It's more fun. I would even consider doing these live if anybody ever wanted to listen to them live. That could be a lot of fun, and you can give me suggestions. You know, let me know if you want me to try to set up a date for that, where you could be, while I'm talking, airing live, giving me ideas for what we should Google and see if we can find, like, you know, the first thing or the second or third something that is, you know, funny or cool or interesting. So as always, find me on all the socials, S_Royt on TikTok, PodPinky, which is on Twitter. And I have pinkyswearpress.com. And I also want to say that my new book, Dark Wings, is out now. Urban fantasy, male-male romance, a little supernatural. Please give it a look. The Kindle is still on pre-order. It will drop into your device June 1st if you order it now. But the paperback is now out. And I am very excited about this one. I thought it was going to be a one-off, but it's not. I'm actually writing two at the same time right now. I can't say too much or I'll spoil, but basically the Dark Wings universe has been born. They're not necessarily all like these direct sequels, but I feel that I have just gave birth to a universe. And one of the characters has been in my brain for years and years and years, and I finally gave him his story. I mean, I've known it, but he's finally gets to share it with the world. So we, Raven and I, really hope that you'll check it out, okay? Please check it out. Available on Amazon.com, all countries. All right, thanks for listening. I hope this was fun. I was having fun. It's kind of crazy. And hit me up, S. Royt, at pinkyswearpress.com. Okay, bye-bye.